two bonus lectures in the CFT course. So today I'm going to try and compute some partition functions and show how they are constrained by modular invariants. So we're going to study CFT on the torus, and I'm going to motivate that for you in a moment. But the goal of today's lecture will be to compute essentially in particular the partition function for the free fermion model and then show that it's the same as the partition function of the Ising model. So that goes on the same lines of discussion you've seen last week. And then tomorrow I will tell you something about theories with boundaries. And I'm not exactly sure yet what is the example that we will do, but if I manage to prepare it today, we might do a percolation, which is actually a really cool example. Okay. Right. So today, as I said, we are doing CFT on the torus. So first, let me just tell you very few words about why we would want to do such a thing. So let's see. So why CFT on the torus? Okay, so there's a variety of answers to this, but okay, the one that is the easiest to perhaps to understand is because of string theory. So there, as I think it was mentioned in the introduction to this course, so CFT arises because you have this the worksheet that is the description of how the string moves in space-time. And on this two-dimensional surface, you have actually a conformal field theory. So you can study string theory perturbatively by studying the conformal field theory on this two-dimensional surface. And there is a genus expansion for all amplitudes. So you need to consider the sphere, then the torus, and then various other surfaces with increasing numbers of holes. And when you are, okay, this is not a nice sphere, sorry. So when you are computing amplitudes there, you need to consider a conformal field theory on the sphere that gives you the leading contribution. And then you have to consider the theory on the torus and so on. So there, at genus one here, you meet the torus that we're going to discuss today. But you don't need to be doing string theory to be interested in studying CFT on the torus, because really the reason what we're going to see today is that on the torus you need you get some constraints coming from modular invariants. And modular invariants will give you some constraints on the spectrum of the theory. So. Okay. So even if you're just doing a CFT for statistical mechanics, you are still interested in studying these constraints that come from putting the theory on the torus. And intuitively, the reason for this is that So far, we've seen only CFT on the full complex plane, and there we are considering the holomorphic sector and the anti-holomorphic sector as independent. But that's a very special case, because as soon as you move a little bit away from the critical point, so where the theory is not conformal anymore, or as soon as you consider the theory on a surface that has some boundary, for example, then the two sectors are not independent anymore. So we want some consistent way to understand how the two sectors are coupled. And one way is to impose modular invariance on the torus. That will tell you what combinations of holomorphic and anti-holomorphic operators can exist in the spectrum. Okay, so this is just as motivation. But now let me just start from the beginning and first of all tell you how we can describe the torus, and then I'll tell you about CFT on the torus. So, right. Okay, so the torus is just a parallelogram with the opposite sides identified. And so we can call, let's call these two, the two periods of the torus, omega 1 and omega 2. So I can specify a torus by giving you two vectors. And telling you that if you do a translation along these two vectors, you come back to the same point. And actually, it's useful to introduce tau, that is, so if you, instead of thinking of this as omega 1 and omega 2, you think of this as points on the complex plane, so this point is, let's call it omega 1, and this is omega 2 here, then we introduce tau, which is the modular parameter of the torus, which is the ratio of these two complex numbers, and is really the only thing that you need to specify to determine which torus you are considering. So if you want to work on the full plane, we can just draw a lattice on the plane. And here I'm going to choose my torus to have omega 1 equals 1, so that this is just tau. And then you can draw full lattice. Oops. Okay, sorry if this is not very, very clear, but the idea is that you can consider at this point any point on the complex plane, but you have to remember that whenever you do a translation by an integer unit of the lattice spacing, an integer multiple of the lattice spacing, then you return to the same point. So for example, this point here is the same as this, 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 and so on. Right. Okay. And here you also see why we have introduced this tau and said that it's the only thing you need to specify to determine the torus, because I can always choose my axis so that I'm putting the torus in this position with omega 1 equals 1, and then tau is really the only thing that that tells me how to draw my, my lattice. Okay. Now, a key point is that not all choices of tau will give you different tori. So for example, consider taking tau and then shifting it by one unit. So here we have, okay, so here is one tau. Okay, so this is our torus, and what we are doing now is we are considering a torus that has this one as new tau, so it's this torus here. Right? Now, this region here is common to the two tori, and this one here is the same as this triangle here, right? So this is this torus here is exactly the same torus that I had before. Okay, so this is an example of a modular transformation. So this is a transformation on tau that leaves the torus unchanged. It just gives you a different way to describe the torus, the same torus. So more generally, you can consider changing basis in your period. So you have omega 2. Let's see which way you want to. Yeah. You can define some new periods as a linear combination of the old ones with the integer coefficients, which is essentially what we have done. Well, this is a specific, very simple example of that. Right, so these A, B, C, and D have to be integers. And for this to be a good change of basis, we need this matrix to be also invertible, and which means that the, I mean, and the inverse should also have integer entries. So we ask that the determinant is 1. A D minus B C equals 1. Okay. Okay, and I hope it's clear that these transformations are always going to be the to give the same torus, just in a different description. So in particular, if we consider just the transformation on tau, then we have the tau prime is a tau plus b over c tau plus d, I think. Okay, and these two taus describe the same torus. So this group here is SL2Z, which is just the group of 2x2 matrices with the integer entries and to have determinant equal to 1. But now if you look here, you also see that if you change the sign to all the coefficients at the same time, then you get the same tau. So we are going to just mod out by this transformation and say that that we don't distinguish those matrices, those in which you change the sign. And this is the modular group. Okay. So whenever we are considering... yes. We do the quotient because if we take take this matrix M, if we take M to minus M, then tau doesn't change. So then we want to identify these two matrices. So that's the quotient. And this is also called PSL2Z, in case you see this. Okay, so whenever we are considering a quantity that is defined on the torus, then we always want to make sure that this quantity doesn't change if we do this transformation of tau, because then that wouldn't be physical. So, and this is the requirement of modular invariance that I was talking about earlier. So one more thing that I can say here maybe quickly is... okay, first of all... So this transformation that I mentioned earlier, let's call it T. So T tau going to tau plus 1. And together with this other transformation S, which brings tau to minus the inverse of tau. So these two transformations generate the modular group. You can show that. You can show that you can write any transformation of that form, but just by composing these two kinds of transformations. So this generate the modular group. And this is important because if you want to check that something is modular invariant, all you have to do is check that these two transformations leave it invariant, and then you're done, essentially. And the last thing that I can say before we switch to considering CFT is that, so I'm telling you that there are various values of tau that are identified, so if you want, you can choose... If you want to have only values of tau that are they give different tori, then you can choose to consider tau only in this region. Let's see. Okay, this is supposed to be a circle of radius 1. Okay, this is minus 1, 1. This is supposed to be 1/2. This is supposed to be minus 1/2. And you can consider tau that lies in this region. And then, with some, here you choose only this side of the boundary, I think. And if you do this, because it is a tau plane, all the tori that you get are different tori. So you're not going to use this today, but it's a picture that you're going to see over and over again, especially when you study string theory. So there it is. Okay, so now let me tell you about conformal field theory on the torus. Okay, so the goal here is we want to define the partition function by studying our conformal field theory on the torus. Now you could think of just doing this and say, okay, I have the complex plane and I'm going to just impose these identifications and study my CFT here. But we want to try and introduce the torus in a way that preserves as much symmetry as possible. And if you do this, you can see that you are essentially breaking all of the group of global conformal transformations. So we're going to do it in a different way instead. So we start from the plane. Then we go to the cylinder, which is the, okay. This is the infinite cylinder. And then we impose some identification here, saying that these two circles are identified. And this way we construct a torus. Now, as I said, the advantage of doing it this way is that, as we are going to see in a moment, we preserve more symmetry like this. So, remember here the map was, so if this is Z and this is W, then we had the exponential map that takes us from the cylinder to the plane. And so here W has, so the imaginary part of W goes around this cycle here in the cylinder, and the real part of W goes on the length of the cylinder. And when we did the radial quantization, we were considering this to be the time direction and this to be our space direction. And these circles map back to circles on the here around the origin in the complex plane, right? So let me just show it in another picture. But if you do this identification, then your torus is now an annulus here around the origin, in which we have identified these two circles. Is that clear? Okay, so let's see. We had these generators of the global conformal transformations that were L naught and L plus 1 and L minus 1. So which ones preserve this this new geometry now? Okay, so the easy one to see is L minus 1. L minus 1 generate translations, so this is not invariant on the translations, right? So we have lost that one. L0 generates dilatations and rotations, so we have those. But, okay, that's a bit more difficult to see, but the special conformal transformations are also not global transformations anymore. So we have global conformal transformations are just generated by L naught and L naught bar. And we can, so if you remember, we had that this combination, so L naught plus L naught bar, was generating dilatations. And on the cylinder, this was just the Hamiltonian. And then the difference is essentially the spin, the generator of rotations. And this was the momentum on the cylinder. Right? OK, so we are going to use this later. But now let me just remind you of how fields transform when you go from the plane to the cylinder. In particular, we need the transformation of the stress tensor. Okay, so that's the sensor on the cylinder as a function of W. Will be just dz by dw here squared, because this is relation to times t of z. And then there is an extra term, because the stress tensor doesn't really transform like a tensor actually under conformal transformations. And this term comes from computing the Schwarzian derivative, which was introduced in class when you were told what is the finite form of the conformal transformation acting on the stress tensor. And this is just third derivative over first derivative z minus 3 by 2 second derivative over first derivative square. Or, where here z is seen as a function of w. Right. Anyway, so if you do this, you get just z squared times the old stress tensor, and then there is a constant here that turns out to be c by 24. And of course, because I wrote here, I mean, on the cylinder, the variable is W, so you have to re-express this in terms of W, but, I mean, which is just just through the fact that Z is e to the W. But I'm keeping it written like that because I want to see what happens to the modes of the stress tensor. So remember that you can write T of Z as, in this mode expansion with the okay, here there is a minus 2 from the dimension of that. And now I want to see what happens to the modes of sort of these LNs once we go to the cylinder. So you can now write T of W on the cylinder as so from this expression, just plug in the mode expansion here. So this z square will cancel this 2 here, and you just get summation of the integers of ln minus this c by 24 that only contributes when n is 0, so delta n 0, and then e to the minus n w. So now this this mode expansion actually looks like a proper Fourier expansion once you're on the cylinder. Yes, it is like an intermediate step. Okay. And in particular, what is important is that we can write L naught on the cylinder as just L naught on the plane minus C by 24. Yes?
If I have a distribution value of T, zero on the plane, the cylinder is not zero anymore.
That's right. That's the, well, in particular, if you consider the energy, so the sum of L0 plus L0 bar, then you're going to get that the energy on the cylinder, actually the energy of the ground state, or the vacuum is not zero, but is minus C by 12, which is the Casimir effect in this case. And normally you can say that you're going to rescale the you're going that you can choose what is the energy of the vacuum, but here we have defined our vacuum on the plane as being preserved by the generators of conformal group. So then once you go to the cylinder, we are stuck with this offset energy here. Any other?
So this is just really a change of coordinates though, right?
Yes.
So suddenly our physics interpretations change just because of change of coordinates. That's
no,
right.
No change in terms of coordinates. They're going from one kind of plane.
Yeah. Right. So just have to do the fact that, like, like something else has happened, right? It's not just a change of coordinates.
Well, it is, okay, it is a change of coordinates that is defined everywhere except 2 points here on the plane. So we have removed the origin, you want, and the point of infinity.
Okay, so
so now that's how you go from a sphere to a cylinder.
Okay, so it's a different like, space network.
Yeah, you could. I mean, it is. It has some different global properties, but the local properties are the same.
Right.
Yeah, for the global properties of right. the utility function, it has changed. But I'm just saying, when I'm doing this transformation here, this is just a local change of coordinate. Well, that depends on the. I guess what I'm saying is that the physics does notice that we have gone now to the cylinder, which is different from the sphere.
Right.
I'm just saying that the computations I'm doing, they all use what we have seen for general changes of coordinates. I'm not doing anything strange, anything different from what we have seen throughout the course.
So the results are different.
It's
usually like the change part something
that happens.
I think
you have something
so. In this case,
it'll be
a
different side. Right.
But let's keep going.
Okay. No, but really, is this a problem? Are people happy with this so far? More or less? Okay, let's keep going a little bit, and then if this is still bothering you, you can try and ask me again. So far we were on the cylinder, now we want to consider the torus. So let's do again our cylinder. Okay, so first of all, as I said, we had W that had the imaginary part around the cylinder and real part along the cylinder. Now we're going to change that, so let's just we define W as IW, just for convenience. So now you have that W is identified by a shift of 2 pi. Okay, so the real part is now going around the cylinder. And now we can introduce our vector tau here and say that the W is also invariant under a shift by 2 pi tau. And let's just write tau as tau 1 plus I tau 2. Okay. All right. Now I want to define the partition function. So normally, I don't know how much you have seen at this, but one way to write the partition function in the operator formalism is just to choose a time direction and then writing the trace of trace e to the minus say L H, where this is the Hamiltonian would be the operator that generates translations along the time direction, and that would be the distance that you are identifying your time direction by. And then this will give you, that will turn out to be related to the temperature, of course. And you can write the partition function like this. Now here, we are going to do something similar. But it's a little subtle because you are considering an identification that doesn't just go up in the time direction, but has a component along the space direction as well, right? Which would be tau 1. Okay, so to do this, we write the following. So we have to shift along tau 1 by using momentum, right? Because the momentum generates translations, space translations. And then we have to shift along the time direction using the Hamiltonian. And the reason why here there is an I and here instead there is a minus sign is just that to do this, you also have to do a weak rotation, so go to imaginary time. So this is why the expression will look like this. So if everybody's happy with this, so now we can try and rewrite this with the operators that generate time and space translations on the cylinder. So we have seen what those are. So this is e to the 2 pi tau 1 times LZ, 0 minus 0 bar on the cylinder. And this is e to the minus 2 pi tau 2, L0 plus L0 bar, again on the cylinder. Okay, and now all we have to do is write this in terms of L0 on the plane. So this gives us the following result. Okay, this result where I have introduced q equals e to 2 pi I tau. Okay, so let me write it again so we can pull out those two terms. And this will just depend on the trace of q to the L naught and the q bar to the L naught bar. Okay. Okay, so this is our expression for the partition function. Now, as you can see, this depends on. So here the trace is taken over our Hilbert space, which is. Which we have seen gets. Is, You can diagonalize L naught and L naught bar, so just consider states that have a definite scaling dimension. And so really all you get up here is the dimensions of all the states in your Hilbert space, right? So if you have the partition function, you can immediately read off all the dimensions of your operators if somebody is just giving to you. Okay, now here the partition function depends on tau through q, right? And we want to impose that z of tau plus 1 should be equal of z of tau, and z of minus 1 by tau should be also equal to z of tau. Okay. And this is the requirement of modular invariance. Okay. Yes.
Left box should the exponent of q bar be c bar?
Oh yes, of course. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Anything else? Okay. Okay. So actually, one comment that I should make is that here I'm writing that z depends only on tau. Of course, I mean z really depends on tau and tau bar, but tau bar is just the complex conjugate of tau. So that's so I'm just going to write tau. So. Okay. Okay, now I would like to tie this up with something that you have already seen in the, oh, is there a question? Okay, something you have already seen in the lectures. So at some point, when we saw that you can write all the descendant states for every conformal family by acting with all the lowering operators, L minus I, there was this question, how do you count how many states there are at each level, right? Which turned out not to be the Fibonacci series at some point. So when that question was asked, we had this, we introduced this expression, which you will probably recognize more if I write it like this. So we had, so here Dn would be the number of states at level n, so the degeneracy of level n. And then we had q to the h plus n, and we can add this term that doesn't change anything. So this this is something that I'm now, in which I'm now just tracing, taking the trace over states that belong to the conformal family with the primary with the primary state with weight h. And well, and I guess you can convince yourself that this is true. And of course, this is the expression we had already seen, in which you can introduce all these this number of states at level n. So the idea is that if you have some way of computing the trace of this operator in the sector H, then you can expand it out and read off all the degeneracies at each level, right? So now the thing that I want you to notice is that you can really write, the partition function really depends on this kind of operator, right? Because here we are tracing over the full Hilbert space, and we can decompose that into conformal families. So we can write the partition function in terms of this kind of object for each conformal family, and of course also in the holomorphic sector. Now, in particular, if you are considering models, that's now restricted to the minimal models in which you have a finite number of conformal families, then you will be able to write the partition function in general in this form. So it will be just what is called the Sesquilinear combination of the characters. So it's just h bar chi h tau chi h bar. Okay, so this where I have introduced this notation, in which this is the character associated with the H. Okay, now the terminology here comes from considering the representations of the conformal algebra, but we don't even need to go into that. All you need to know is that the character is really this expression, just the trace of Q to the L naught over all the states in the conformal family labeled by H. And if you have a finite number of conformal families, then your partition function will be just written in this form, in which here these coefficients, they are telling you how many times each conformal family appears in the spectrum of your theory. And it's telling you how the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic sector are related. So again, if somebody gives me a partition function here, I can just look at what combinations of these characters appear, and I can read off what are the operators, what combinations of holomorphic and anti-holomorphic operators appear. Right? Yes? Well, yeah, I was saying, now I'm just saying this for minimal models. If you have a minimal model, then you can write this, and this is a sum over a finite number of conformal families. Now, these coefficients will be fixed, well, maybe not uniquely, but are constrained by the requirement of modular invariance. So you have to impose that. And so one thing that, so you can compute these characters explicitly for the minimal models, and we're not going to do that now, so I cannot show you what combinations are modular invariant, but once you do, if you did that, you would find that there is actually a way to classify all possible modular invariant partition functions for minimal models, and those are related somehow to the classification of simply Lie algebras, but we are not going to talk about that. This is just a comment. The only reason why I'm writing this is because I want to tell you that for the Ising model, you would have an expression that looks like this. Okay. So these are the values of H that are allowed in the Ising model. Right? We remember we saw that we had the identity operator, then this operator epsilon, and the sigma, which is related to the spins, right? So this is what is called the diagonal partition function because because this matrix is diagonal, essentially. Now, it turns out that if you know how the modular transformation acts on the characters, you find that when you do the shift in tau, you normally pick tau going to tau plus 1, normally you pick up a phase, which is why by taking this diagonal combinations always gives you something invariant, and then the transformation S is just essentially reshuffling these characters around. So which is why the modular, the diagonal combination always works. Okay. So I'm going a bit quick with this because now I want to show you instead some explicit computations with the fermions. And then I want to show you that you can actually rewrite the partition function that we will obtain in this form. So here I have just given you a general picture, but of course I haven't given you the details, so it's understandable if it looks a bit abstract, of course. Okay, are there any questions so far? Otherwise I'll try to move on to the free fermion model so we can see something concrete. This was briefly introduced in class when we discussed the Ising model, right? And it's the action, let's write it like this. So it's a model of Majorana fermion in two dimensions with this kind of action. And let me just describe in a little more detail that you have seen earlier this theory now before we consider the partition function. So we have seen already that here C equals to C bar equals 1/2, which is why this corresponds to one of the minimal models, so C is less than 1. And you can write, so you can you can compute the stress tensor and find that it is given by this expression. What's that? Now I'm not going to derive this, but the simplest way actually to convince yourself that this is actually the stress tensor is to compute the OP of this with the psi and find that it correctly gives you that the dimension of psi is 1/2. Right. So let me just remind you of this part. So we have two fields, psi and psi bar, which have the following weights. So psi has h equals 1/2, which is bar equals 0, and the other way around for psi bar. So let's compute the scaling dimension now. Okay, so this is 1/2 for both of them. And the spin is h minus h bar, as we have seen, because the generator of rotation is L0 minus L0 bar. And here you get 1/2 and minus 1/2. So these are the left movers and right movers, because they rotate in opposite direction. Okay. So now let's expand in modes this operator, operator psi. So we can write psi of z as sum over n psi n z to the minus n minus 1/2. So here we always put here the value of h because it helps when we do conformal transformations. Okay, so here notice that I'm not telling you where what we are really summing over. I'm not telling you what is n. So as we have seen earlier as well, there are really two different choices you can make for fermions on the plane. So you can have fermions that go back to themselves when you rotate when you go around circle around the origin, or fermions that go to minus themselves. Those are both allowed. So we can see from here that if n is integer, then this corresponds to periodic or antiperiodic fermions. So what you have to do is you have to tell me to look what if you take z to e to the 2 pi I z, what happens to psi. So if n is integer, then you pick up a minus sign. So this is antiperiodic. And the periodic case will be when n is half integer. Now let's construct the space of states for this theory. And so normally we have said you can just define your vacuum to be annihilated by L, the positive modes of L of T, and then you can construct all your states by acting with the L minus I. Here we are going to do it in a different way and then relate it to that picture. So because we have expanded psi mode, and this mode also satisfies this anti-commutation relation. Zero. So you can think of the positive modes as annihilation operators and negative modes as creation operators, just like we did for T. So we can define our vacuum to be annihilated by the positive modes. and then we can write our states in each sector just by acting with the negative mode. So here in the periodic sector, so we have the vacuum, then we have psi minus 1/2 times the vacuum, psi minus 3/2. And you can have more than one of them, of course. So we always order them with the lowest mode first, and so on. Right. Now there is a subtlety if you're considering the antiperiodic sector, because there the vacuum is degenerate, and you can see this because for every n that is different from zero, you get that the anticommutator is zero. So you can, and also you can see from this expression that, but okay, maybe I should have told you something else first. Okay, yeah, I should have told you something else first, but we are going to see in a moment that the psi zero also contributes zero energy when it acts on a state. So then we have this vacuum, but we can also consider this, and they both will have the same value of h. We are going to see that in a moment. Anyway, because of this reason, we have to find some way to distinguish between these two vacua, and one way to do it is to introduce this operator minus 1 to the f, where f is the fermion number operator that counts how many fermions you have in a given state. So you can write f, if you want, as the summation over k of psi minus k psi k. And you can convince yourself that this is going to count the number of fermions that you, fermionic modes that are used to create a given state. And just for later, we can also rewrite this like this, defining fk as the fermion number for the kth mode. Essentially, this is telling you whether your state contains psi k or not, essentially. Okay, now we have that, so this operator anti-commutes with all the modes, with all the psi k's. So in particular, it anti-commutes with psi zero. So we can define our states to have a definite value of minus 1 to the f. And actually here, okay, let me put that we are in the antiperiodic sector, because this is not quite the same vacuum as the one that we have here. Because as we have seen when we were discussing the Z model, when you have... So to create the vacuum in the antiperiodic sector, you need to act with an operator at the origin, an operator that has an OPE with psi that has a fractional power, that such that it enforces this antiperiodicity. So then putting it all together, so we have that the two vacua in the theory can be. Let me first write it, and then I'll try to explain to you why this is the case. So this we call 1 by 16 plus, and then okay. So I'm just telling you that the ground state in the antiperiodic sector can be obtained by acting with this operator sigma inserted at the origin. And the dimension of this operator is 1 by 16. So I'm denoting the ground state with this notation 1 by 16. And then I'm distinguishing two possibilities. So this one will have fermion number 0. So I get, if I act with minus 1 to the F, I get a plus, which is why I have this little plus here. Then the other possibility, we have to have ground state that has a negative eigenvalue of minus 1 to the F, because I'm just breaking the degeneracy in my vacuum by diagonalizing minus 1 to the F. And it turns out that this can actually be obtained acting with the operator mu at 0. Remember that mu appeared when we were considering the OPE of psi with sigma, and we got some z minus w, the minus 1/2 times the operator mu, right? So you can see that mu, just by, well, plus other terms, so mu has to have fermion the same fermion number as psi for this OPE to make sense. So this is the vacuum with fermion number 1. Okay, does this make sense? More or less? Yes? Yes, yes, it is the same sigma as the Eisenmodel sigma. Because we saw that this sigma exists in the theory of free fermions just because, precisely, it is the operator that creates the antiperiodic sector of the free fermion model, essentially.
One thing, you just mentioned that those two states are all vacuum states, so we have to do something to distinguish them. But I don't really get why you define the fermion number and you can distinguish the vacuum.
Well, the reason why is because just like psi 0, this this operator minus 1 to the f anti-commutes with all the modes. So I can, and in particular it anti-commutes with the psi 0, so I can just, so these they form a closed algebra, and I can just represent it on my state, by the, and I sort of diagonalize my vacuum on that, but not vacuum, ground state, okay. Is that okay? This is not. I mean, it is crucial, but it's not necessarily crucial for what we are doing now. So I think that. Well, okay. I hope you understand more or less what this means. But maybe let me just write down some states for this case, and then go on and see if there are still doubts once we do a bit more. Okay. Oh yes. So this was. Well, the spin operator or order operator, and this was the disorder operator for the Eisenmodel, right? Okay. So just like we did before, let's just write a few states here, and we get so we have the ground states plus minus. Then we can act with psi minus 1. On either one of them, and so on.
But not psi 0.
Can we also write? No, psi 0 relates actually the two ground states, like we said. That is, two are both ground states.
Okay.
Right. Okay, is that okay? Right. I mean, it's going to be much clearer now in a moment when I tell you one more thing, which is how to write L0 in terms of these modes, because then for each of these states, you can see what is their conformal dimension. Okay. So let's just do that here. I'm going a little slow, I think. Anyways, okay. I told you that the stress tensor was this. So here we have the normal ordering, and then psi. Okay, wait. This is really bad. Sorry. Okay, so now you can just plug in here the mod expansion of psi and compare with the mod expansion of t, and read off for each mod ln of t what is the expression in terms of mod of psi. There is a subtlety here because if you do that, you'll get some infinite sums. So here we interpret this normal ordering as being subtract the infinite part of the sum, put all your annihilation operators first, and that's your normal ordered expression. There is some way to justify what we are doing some zeta function regularization. But ultimately, what we really want is that is to reproduce what we expect for the energy of the vacuum, and so that will be the proof that we have done something correct. So let me just write down what you get. So you get that the ln is just given by this expression with the okay, so here this is just obtained by plugging in the mod expansion of psi and comparing with the mod expansion of t. Nothing has happened yet. Then we just have to specify whether we are considering n to be integer or half integer. So let's consider the periodic sector first, which is, as we have seen, with the half-integer modes. So n is z plus 1/2. So in this case, if we do what I just said, we get that, in particular, L0 is equal to the sum over just positive half-integer k's times psi minus k psi k, which is also, I mean, here you can recognize that fermion number operator that I introduced earlier. So this is also k f k. Okay. As I said, to go from here to here, you have to put always the positive k's in front. So which is how we get finally to this expression with the k just greater than 0 and the 1/2 goes away. And then from this part here, you are going to get an infinite sum, which we subtract. So that the vacuum state in the periodic sector correctly will have energy 0. Is that clear? Because now you can go back to the list of states here and compute what is L0 plus L0 bar, which L0 bar will be obtained exactly in the same way, of 0, and you'll find 0. So this is ultimately what justifies subtracting this infinite sum in the way we did. Good for everybody? And so what would be the value of what would be the eigenvalue of L naught of this state under of L naught acting on this state? So you have to count the number of fermionic modes you have to count the number of fermionic modes and then multiply with this little subscript here. So here we have 0 of all modes except psi minus 1/2, and so this will give me h equals 1/2.
So first of all, over k over half integers?
Sorry, I wrote n and then I used k, I'm really sorry.
Like this
cell,
I
see. Yeah. So what about
wait, why one half and not negative one half? If the k of these guys is
because
does that k ask how many negative one half?
This is k is asking how many Simon fk is asking how many Simon's k we have. As you can see from here, because this one is going to delete it and this one is going to put it back.
Oh yeah, okay, sure. So
So for example, what is the value of h for this state here?
3x.
Wow, that's good. Okay, this one is harder. Which is 2, okay, good. Yes. 3 halves plus 1 half. Okay. And so on. Okay. All right. Okay, in the antiperiodic sector, we have k now an integer, and we find again something similar. But now we have an extra constant. And this is just because the ground state in this sector has is created by an operator that has dimension 1 by 16. So this is 0, fk plus 1 by 16. Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you. And now from here, you see that these two states here, they have the same energy, right? Because psi 0 is excluded from that sum. So psi 0 contributes 0 energy. Which is why we are saying that they're both, it's another way to see why these are both both ground states. So now let's see what is the value of h for these states here. So this one has h equals 1 by 16. What about this one? Yeah, we can write it as 1 plus 1 by 16. We don't have to. Okay. Okay, so I guess it's, so this is 2 plus 1 by 16 and so on. Right? Okay. All right. Okay, so here we were still on the cylinder. Now, well, no, actually, we were still on the plane. Sorry, I have to first go to the cylinder and then go to the torus. Okay. Okay, so. Again, this was the picture. So we have the plane. We go first on the infinite cylinder, and then from here we can go to the torus. Okay. So let's just do the first step. Here there is only one subtlety to notice. So if we transform. So we consider psi on the cylinder. Again, it's similar to what we saw earlier for the stress tensor. So here we get dz by d w, this time to what power? Yeah, so the transformation here is normally h, right? So we have this is psi of z. So what is... h for the fermion? Oh, it's no, it's h. Yeah, I think so. I mean, it depends on whether you write it to dw by the dz or dz by dw.
Sorry.
Okay, so if this is going to be 1/2 of what the factor, right? And so this gives us z 1/2. Now let's write the mode expansion. Okay. So here, this 1/2 cancels that 1/2, so we just get the Fourier expansion. But here it never mattered whether n was integer or half integer. Now the thing that you have seen is that because there is this extra power, this is z to the 1/2 that comes in, you can easily convince yourself now that when on the plane we have periodic fermions, which was n being half integer, then on the cylinder we get antiperiodic boundary conditions around the cylinder. And similarly, I mean, they get exchanged. So when n is integer on the plane, that's corresponded to antiperiodic boundary conditions going around the origin, and now it becomes periodic around the cylinder. Just because, again, you have to see what is... you have to just take psi of w on the cylinder, and then you have to consider psi. You have to shift w by 2 pi I. Remember that the imaginary direction w is around the cylinder. So w plus 2 pi I. And then see what that gives in the two cases for antiperiodic and periodic boundary conditions. And it's the opposite as before, just because there is no square root here that earlier we had. Right? Okay. So I guess you get psi of w if n is half integer, and you get psi minus psi on w if n is integer. No, the other way around. Sorry. Okay. Is that correct? Yeah, this is antiperiodic and periodic on the cylinder. Okay. Okay, let's see if we can quickly do. Okay, now we want to consider the partition functions. We want to go on the torus, and we can learn a lot of things just from little drawings for a little bit. So just like going around one cycle on the cylinder, we have the possibility of choosing periodic or antiperiodic boundary conditions. Once we identify two circles here on the cylinder, then we have the choice of periodic or antiperiodic boundary conditions also around these other cycles. These are the two cycles in the torus, one that goes around the torus like this, and one here, right? Okay, so we can represent that by saying that there are four possibilities. I can have antiperiodic boundary conditions along one cycle and antiperiodic along the other cycle. I can have antiperiodic and periodic. Periodic and antiperiodic, and I can have what did I miss? Periodic and periodic, right? Now you could ask, why do I even need to consider all these things? There might be some principle that tells me what what I should consider, or I can just decide to restrict to one of these sectors and go on. Right? But actually, the requirement of modular invariance will tell you that you need to consider all of these. And to see that, let's just try to understand what the modular transformations do to these boundary conditions. So remember that we had these transformations, tau going to tau plus 1, and the other one was tau going to minus 1 over tau. Okay. So what happens if you do this kind of transformation? So let's try to see. You have your torus. So this is tau, right? And now you're shifting. You're considering this other description of the torus, right, like this. I'm not sorry. Yes, this description of the torus, okay? So this is your new tau prime equals tau plus 1. Now, suppose you have antiperiodic boundary conditions here, and you had periodic boundary conditions here. To go from this point to this point, you need to go through periodic and then antiperiodic. So the result will be antiperiodic. If you had had periodic boundary conditions here, nothing would have changed. You would have just gotten periodic again. So this is telling us that what we expect from a modular transformation is that if I have A here on the bottom, then this one on the side is going to be exchanged. So I'm going to exchange these two. And instead, if I had here P, then this would just go back to itself. That clear? Now, I'm not telling you that this is not an equation. As in, there might be some there will actually be some phase factors in front of this, but this is just an expectation from looking at these pictures essentially. Okay, so this was for t. This one is even simpler because if you go back to if you look at what this means when you act on the two periods of the torus, this one was just this matrix. Sorry. Omega 1, 2 prime equals this acting on 1 and 2. Okay. You can convince yourself that this is what this operation on tau does on omega 1 and omega 2 if tau is defined as omega 1 over omega 2. So this mysterious transformation S really is just exchanging the two cycles of the torus, right? So then, again, in picture, what do we expect these boundary conditions to go to? If they're both periodic, if I exchange the two cycles, it's going to be the same thing. This is still going to be periodic. Antiperiodic will go through the same thing. But antiperiodic and periodic will go to periodic and antiperiodic, just the opposite. So these get exchanged. Okay. So again, this is just an expectation, but in this case, it turns out to be exactly correct. There will be no phase factors. So from just these arguments, you see that you can't just restrict to one choice of boundary conditions along the cycles of the torus, because when you impose that the theory must be modular invariant, then you get back in all the other sectors. Which is not exactly all the other sectors, because you can see that, so you can either consider periodic and periodic boundary conditions, and this always goes to itself, or you could consider a combination of the other ones. But it actually turns out that you need to consider all of them together, but just from this you would you have this choice of what sectors you want to consider. Okay. Now I want to actually compute this for you. And we are almost done, but I hope you can hold on to the end, because well, it might look all very abstract, but I'm trying to tell you the little story of how the fermions are the same as the Ising model, and so we just need to get to the end to see that. Okay, so let's compute this, which is actually the trace over the antiperiodic sector of Q of L naught over the cylinder. Okay? So this is something that will appear in the partition function, right? I'm just saying that the trace that I have in the partition function, I can compute it by restricting to each sector, because the sectors don't really talk to each other, right? And I'm just computing the holomorphic part here. Okay? Yes? Well, I mean, if I have a Q to the naught acting on an operator with weight H, then this is going to be Q to the H times that operator. This is easy because we have diagonalized this operator. So all the states we are considering have just a definite eigenvalue. So, yes, so this so is all we mean. Well, yeah, you can, if you want to think of it that way, but it's really what it is, actually. It's,
what about when Q was minus 1 and there was F to be followed? It would not work in the same way.
What about what study?
When you had on that board, you had the operator that counts the number of fermions or something. Minus 1.
Oh, minus 1 to the power of F, yes.
So then when it acts on something, it F would just get replaced by...
yes, it just, that's right, that's
okay.
Right. Okay, let me just remind you that the partition function was some trace of Q to L naught in the cylinder and Q bar, L naught bar again on the cylinder. Right. So all I'm doing here is I am saying that I can compute these pieces separately before because the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic sector don't talk to each other, and then within the holomorphic sector I can choose in which sector I am of what are called the spin structures, so periodicity conditions on the fermions, and just compute it there. So I'm computing for you one piece of the partition function now. Okay. So this is the trace in the antiperiodic sector of Q to the L naught times Q to the minus 1/48, because the C is 1/2, so we had C by 24, and so it becomes C by 1 by 48. And now you just use what we saw earlier, which hopefully is still there, for what? No, it's not there anymore. Well, okay, so we had seen that L0 could be written as the summation over k greater than 0, k f k, right? Okay, so we are computing this trace. Here we are considering half integer modes, right? Because we are in the antiperiodic sector. So we are doing, so we can pull out this q to the minus 148. And then we have the trace of q sum over k fk. Now, from here, it's just simple manipulations. So you can write this as the product over k of the trace of q to the k fk. Yes?
If we are on the periodic sector, don't we have 16 on Lamont? No, that happens
in the periodic sector now because they got exchanged when we got, yeah. That's why I'm doing this one because it's the simple, I mean, simplest in a way. Yeah. Okay. So here now, you are just taking the trace in the sector that has modes k, right? So this is really just this a trace that has two terms because you can either not have psi minus k, or you can have psi minus k, in which case you get q to the k, right? Is that that clear? So anyway, so this is just minus 148 product per k of this 1 plus q the k. Okay, so you can leave, so this is k greater than 0 and half integer. So you can, this is the answer. You can leave this answer in this form if you want. Or you can also realize that this can be written as in terms of theta and theta functions like this, where there is nothing really mysterious. So this theta 3 of tau is just a product from n from 1 to infinity of 1 minus q to the n 1 plus q to the n minus 1 half squared, and the eta of tau is equal to q 1 by 24 product of n of 1 to infinity 1 minus q of n. Okay. So you can just see that, you can see very easily why this is true, right? Because here we have this minus 1 half, but we are here we were taking the sum of the rest half integer modes, so it all works out.
Okay. In that, what happened to the central charge? Because that 1 over 48 is because we had 1 over 24 before, but now h is 1 half.
No, that is because c is 1 half. We had c by 24. Okay, so now the advantage of writing it in this form is that these theta functions and the eta functions are things that. Yes, sorry, question?
Yeah. What's the tau dependent?
Oh, is it in q? Q. It's inside q. Q, remember, it's e to the 2 pi I tau.
Right, then what's that q to the power of 1 over 2 h? Just in the line below in your eta function.
Here?
Yeah, what's the power of
that? 1 by 24. Yeah, this is so actually this is quite nice because these functions were defined without any relation to conformal field theory, just as some functions that transform nicely on the torus. So they have nice modular transformations. However, you get exactly the same sort of powers that you get from CFT because, well, really there is a relation between modular independence and CFT. Okay. So in exactly the same way, you can compute all the other ones if you want, which I'm not going to do also because I'm already going over time and I still have maybe 10 minutes if people can hold on. So I'm not going to compute the other ones. In fact, if you are so inclined, you can try to do it, and there is really nothing to it other than this. The only thing that I have to tell you, though, is because nobody has asked me, and I was very happy, why here I say that this is the antiperiodic boundary condition in this direction. And so here I'm just using the fact that somehow the fermion naturally has, once I go to the cylinder and the torus, antiperiodic boundary condition. So if I don't do anything, then the fermion will have antiperiodic boundary condition. If I want to have periodic boundary conditions in this direction, I know that I have to act, that I have to act on the vacuum with the operator sigma that creates a branch cut and that makes the fermion has now periodic boundary condition. If I want to select the periodic boundary conditions in the time direction, then I have to insert in the trace an operator that anti-commutes with my fermions, so that once I go around the circle, the fermion comes back with a different sign, right? So what is that operator? An operator that anti-commutes with all my fermionic modes. Right, the minus one to the F operator. So if I want to compute, for example, okay, let's see. If I want to compute the same thing, so in the antiperiodic sector, but with periodic boundary conditions in the time direction, then I will just have to insert minus one to the F in the trace. So if you want to compute this, yes, this is going to be the same thing. So Q to the minus 1 by 48 trace in the antiperiodic sector, so which means half integer modes. But now you have Q to the L naught and then minus 1 to the F. And if you remember that this is actually minus 1 to the sum over K, K, FK, then you can do the same steps you did before, except that at some point when you encounter the trace in the sector K of this Q, K to the F, K, minus 1 to the F, K, you will get 1 minus Q to the K as opposed to plus because of this minus 1 to the F, K. And you can do the same thing. And in this case, you are going to find this is theta 4 of tau by eta of tau. And similarly, if you do what do you do? Antiperiodic periodic, you get theta 2. This is the one I haven't used yet, I think. Now, here there is a subtlety that I'm not going to talk much about, but if you consider the periodic sector, then this would be equal to theta 1 of tau by eta of tau, except that this is also 0. Theta 1 of tau is 0. So this, and remember, this was the one that we said was somehow special because it's modular invariant by itself, in a way, right? And it actually vanishes because this is the sector in which we have zero modes, and the zero mode will just give you zero. Now, you could expand a little bit on that, but there isn't really time right now, so I'll just say it as a comment here. Okay, so we are almost done. We can write down the full partition function for the fermions on the torus now. So I'm going. So here you just have to take my word for it or open a book after we are done here. But if you actually look up the modular transformations of the theta functions and delta functions, then you're going to reproduce the thing that I just erased right now. So, as I said, for the shift tau going to tau plus 1, there are going to be some phases that pop out. And so we get rid of those by considering just by pairing together the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic sector. So we consider things like this, right? And then the other expectation we had for the reshuffling of the boundary conditions under the transformation S is exactly satisfied without any phase. So then we find that this thing here that I'm going to write now is modular invariant. So okay. So we can take this as our partition function, where you have to substitute for these symbols the actual expression in terms of thetas and etas, right? And secretly, there is here also a term with the periodic boundary condition, which, as we said, is zero, but as we'll see hopefully in the next 5 minutes, so you have to really keep it, because when you do something other than just computing the partition function, it will actually play a role. Because now we are computing the partition function is really just like computing the expectation value of the identity on the torus. But then, of course, there is more fun to be had by inserting other operators. So once you do that, then this sector will also play a role. Okay, so now the last thing we want to do before we leave is that I want to show you how you can think of this as the partition function of the Ising model, which we said was, we had that for the Ising model, we had this combination of characters that I introduced earlier. Right. Where here each of these was just the trace over, so for example, this is h equals 0 of q to the L naught minus c by 24, and so on, right? Okay. So even though I didn't tell you what these expressions were earlier, what we can do is just look at what states should contribute to this trace and compare with the states that contributed when you computed those terms earlier. And just to make it less abstract, let's look at the states we had in the antiperiodic sector, right? So there we had, so in the antiperiodic sector, when we computed these two terms here, we were considering states that were built on the vacuum, acting with the half-integer modes of psi, right? So we had this, psi minus 1 half 0, psi minus 3 half 0, psi minus 3 half, psi minus 1 half 0, and so on, right? With values of h, 0, 1 half, 3 half, and 2, and so on. Now, in this trace taken in the conformal family that is built from the identity, we expect to have conformal dimensions that are integer, right? 0, 1, 2, 3, because every time we act with, so we start from 0, and every time we act with L minus 1, for example, we go down to, we increase the conformal dimension by 1 unit, right? If we were in considering the conformal family with the primary that has h equals 1 half, we would expect to have dimensions that are 1 half plus integers. So 1 half, 3 halves, and so on. We can see just by writing the first four terms here that obviously these is just the sum of, so this is just the conformal family with H equals 0 plus, let me just not even, plus the conformal family with H equals 1/2. Now, you might think that there is a little mystery here because H equals 1 is missing, right? But I'm sure that what you have learned in this course, you know exactly why that state is missing. So I leave that as something that you can answer during the Christmas holidays. Instead, let's just try and find a way to disentangle those two conformal families. So how can you distinguish states that come from the identity and states that come from this epsilon operator? Okay, here I wrote maybe too few states to observe that, but somehow it is obvious that because psi has contributes 1/2, then if you have an even number of psi's, then you have integer conformal weights. Like integer H comes always if you have an even number of psi's, like 0 and 2 here, for example. And if you have an odd number of psi's, then you are always going to get H that is odd. So like an even fermion number would be corresponding to this case, and odd fermion number is this case, right? And so we can just write our character for this family as just a projection onto even fermion number of the trace in the antiperiodic sector, right? So this is Q to the minus 1 by 48. Then we have 1/2 because we are doing a projection, let's say trace over the antiperiodic sector. 1 plus minus 1 to the f q the L naught. Okay? And if you want to get the chi 1/2, that will be the same thing, but now I'm projecting over the sector with odd fermion number. Now let's just look at the other and at the periodic sector. Now here we had states that had 1 by 16 plus minus psi minus 1, 1 by 16 plus minus, and so on, right? So these are just two copies of the, so if you have H, this is 1 by 16, 1 plus 1 by 16. So whether we choose the ground state with the even fermion number or with odd fermion number, we are going to get the same, at our state that have the same dimensions. So we can choose either one. And in fact, if we wanted, so we for example, choose the one with the even fermion number, which means that chi 16 would be the Q minus 1 by 48 trace over the periodic sector, say something 1/2, 1 minus 1 plus, yes, 1 plus minus 1 to the f q to the L naught. Okay. But I could equally choose the one with the minus sign, and it would be the same thing. Now, let's just rewrite this in terms of our little square notation up there. So remember that I told you that if you want to change the boundary condition in the time direction, you insert minus 1 to the f. So this that I wrote here is just 1/2 times this plus this. And this, okay, and this is 1/2. Times the same thing. So this is 1/2 of P A P plus or minus P. Well, actually, this one is zero, as we said. Okay, so this is essentially the end of it, but let me just write it in one expression. So if you compute, so if we rewrite this in terms of theta functions, so the partition function of the fermions was equal to theta 2 by eta plus theta 3 by eta plus theta 4 by eta. And we just showed that this is the same as 2 times the partition function of the Ising model. Where this is the partition function of the Ising model. Okay. Now, this is telling us what the operator content of the theory is. It's telling us that we have, it's telling us that if we consider this partition function on the for the fermions, then the operators that we really have in the theory are not psi or psi bar, but really the identity. An operator that is epsilon of z, z bar. So this one has h, the same value of h and h bar, right? And this one was psi, is identified with psi, psi bar. And it's telling us that we have either sigma or mu, depending on whether we have chosen the plus or minus sign here. When we compute the partition function, we can't tell, but when we compute other things, we can. And and this is the same in the model. If you wanted to have the operator psi in the theory, you would have to have in the partition function a term like psi chi 1/2 chi bar 0, for example. And this would be a non-diagonal modular inversion. Well, if you could build a partition function that has this term, you would have a non-diagonal modular invariant. You can actually almost do it, but you are going. If you want, you can get a theory that has the identity psi, psi bar, and epsilon. It is non-diagonal, the partition function, but it is not quite invariant under the full modular group. It would be invariant under the transformation S, and then shifts in tau going to tau plus 2. And this is because fermions really like to live on a double cover of the space in which they are. So it will not be fully. Okay, and the last comment I want to make is that you can actually think of this partition function as realizing a situation in which you put your Ising model on a square lattice, say, and you impose the periodic boundary conditions on the spin along both directions. This you can see because, you have to look what boundary conditions, what we have imposed for the fermion, what boundary conditions is implied for sigma, and that's what you, that's what it means, that's what you find. But if you want, again, you can try to realize different boundary conditions on the spins. And if you do that, and you consider anti-periodic boundary conditions in one direction, for example, and periodic on the other, then you can obtain that theory that I just said that has the fermions as basic degrees of freedom. But to actually do that in formula, you need to think of inserting an operator in the trace that changes the sign of sigma, and that is a little complication, but you can do that. Okay, so this was more or less all I had planned to say today. I'm sorry it took so long. I hope that it was reasonably clear. And tomorrow, for those who still have the strength to come back here, I want to tell you something about theories with boundaries. And I can hopefully show to you a really, really cool computation and percolation model that will prove to you that CFT is actually useful. Okay, so that's enough for today. Thank you.